Guys, today's episode is being brought to you by Lynda.com. Look, if you want to be a worse photographer, I would recommend taking extremely close pictures of shiny things with the flash on. If you want to have a worse website, you can add one of those counter things that websites used to have on them that says how many people have ever been there. But if you want to do those things better, if you want to be a better photographer, if you want to make your website better, whether it's learning how to code or how to do graphic design, you can learn all those things at Lynda.com. No matter what you're looking to do, they've probably got a course on it as long as you're looking to do it better. So go to Lynda.com/crack today. That's LYNDA.com/crack for a 10-day free trial. Today's episode is being brought to you by a new show called Difficult People. It's coming from executive producer Amy Poehler, and it's a new Hulu original comedy series. Billy Eichner and Julie Klausner star in this unapologetic story about best friends seeking fame and acceptance in the cutthroat New York comedy scene. Figuratively, not literally cutthroat. If you've seen the show Billy on the Street or any of his videos online, you know he's extremely funny, and it's basically like the new Curb Your Enthusiasm with Billy Eichner and Julie Klausner. So catch the premiere of Difficult People Wednesday, August 5th, and watch new episodes on Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
She can say in her voice, in her way, that she love me. With her eyes, with her smile, with her belt, with her hands, with her money. I am the thesis of her prayers. Her nieces and her nephews are just pieces of the layers. Only one she loves as much as me is Jesus Christ and Taylor.
Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name's Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and this week we're listening to Sunday Candy by Donnie Trumpet and the Social Experiment, which is Chance the Rapper's live band. It's off their new album, Surf, which is free to download on iTunes, and it's worth it. There's some great songs on there. And we're starting with a song that's at least partially about church, mostly about his grandma, but he compares her house to Noah's Ark and the biblical flood of Southside Chicago. Guy really writes well about rain, uses that metaphor a lot. Anyways, the song felt appropriate for this week's episode, even though we're not talking about religion specifically. Sorry to disappoint your religion heads out there. This episode actually made me think about the value of religion just from a historical perspective, but what we're talking about is Crime and Punishment. If you own the book, feel free to skip this podcast. The Dostoevsky novel is basically like a Cliff's Notes version of what we'll be covering, so you probably have the gist. But this episode also made me think about that short story, The Lottery, about like a modern town where they stone you for winning the lottery and everyone plays. I know you'd think that'd be a less popular lottery, but it's considered an American literary classic, and not like the Naked Lunch type of American literary classic nobody actually reads. It was at least assigned reading when I was in sixth grade. I don't know if it still is, but even if you haven't read that specific short story, it's also the basic premise of the Hunger Games novel by Suzanne Collins. She was like, good idea, American literary classic, but what if instead of getting stoned to death, I stole the plot from that Stephen King novel and movie, The Running Man, and replaced Arnold Schwarzenegger with a strong female protagonist named Katniss Everdeen? Which, by the way, that always felt to me like the female protagonist equivalent of naming your bad guy Houndshire Magnavox or like Wolfstrike McHammer mean. Anyways, I'm not complaining. It's a great name. It's just a testament to how few female protagonists we've had that it was left. And I'm also not complaining about the plot of The Running Man being put on the end there. It's more entertaining and translates better to movies than a public stoning. For my money, at least. Never been a fan of public stonings. But the woman who wrote that story the first time, Shirley Jackson, she published it in The New Yorker in the 40s, and it immediately showed that like telltale sign of being a piece of writing that's worth a damn, in that people were fucking furious. Like, she got just a deluge of hate mail, and even her mother wrote her and was like, this is a specific quote, actually, Dad and I did not care at all for your story in The New Yorker. Anyways, after researching this week's episode and having the conversation you're about to hear, her story and people's reaction to it both make a lot more sense to me, as does my favorite movie line to quote from Unforgiven, deserves got nothing to do with it, mister. I think there are some things about justice and the fairness of life in general that we don't like to put into words, but that we understand on some like base level with the unconscious part of our minds that nightmares come out of. And I think the thing that scared people about that story is the same thing that we're going to be talking about today. Oh, and I almost forgot, we have a live podcast coming up at UCB on Sunset. We did a show there before. It went great. We had a lot of fun, but it sold out pretty quickly. So go get your tickets now. It's this Wednesday, August 12th at 7 p.m. Tickets are $5, and they're on sale at sunset.ucbtheater.com. That's sunset.ucbtheatre.com. So yeah, I'll leave it at that. This version of me here in the future will be back sporadically to talk about the music you're listening to. And at the end, for some footnotes, I will talk to you then.
Mine's handmade, pan fried, sun dried, south side, and beat the devil by a landslide. Praying with a hands tied, president on my fan club, Santa. Something told me I should bring my
money. Gotta move it slowly, taking in my body like it's holy. Waiting for you for the whole week. I've been praying for you. You're my Sunday.
So I'm joined by Jason Pargin, who writes on the site as David Wong, one of the most popular writers on the internet and anywhere. And Jason, I understand you have a book coming out fairly soon.
Yes, I do, Jack. It's coming October 6th. The title is Futuristic Violence and Fancy Suits. You can pre-order it anywhere on Amazon, or please go to your local bookstore if you can. If you don't support those bookstores, they will go away. And I have two more months of just relentlessly promoting this book, which is very difficult. I'm starting to think, not to get off the subject, that in the world of authors, that it's not the really good authors that become successful. It's the ones that can tolerate just relentlessly promoting themselves the most. Because it's not easy. That's much harder than writing the book part.
The most annoying people in your social media feed, you should tell them to go write a book. They will have a successful career as an author. Well, your book may be about futuristic violence, Jason. You and I were having a conversation about historical violence. How about that segue? I'm on fire. But essentially, it was about a pitch that had come to us. We recently did an article about problems that are sort of edited out of history for whatever reason, because they don't really fit the shape that history books want to give to historical events, or they're gross, like things like how huge a problem it was, just human and animal waste, getting rid of that stuff. Like, that was before global warming, that was our huge problem, was that city streets were covered in human waste, and there were like these rivers of poop flowing under cities that people would like fall through the floorboards of poorly built homes and be swept away in rivers of shit forever. I've talked about that on past podcasts. This is an entry that didn't make the cut, but that I still think is interesting in that it changed the way I thought about history. And it was about how bad we were at solving crimes for most of our history as a species. There really was no good way to tell if someone had actually committed a crime. You know, before the advent of photography, there were no mugshots. Mugshots had to be invented because a officer in Paris was like, man, I've seen the same criminal get arrested 5 times this week, and each time he gave a different name. Well, what should we do about that? That thought process had to happen before they came up with mugshots. But we've had fingerprints since around the same time, but otherwise it was just eyewitness testimony. Like, the lady from town claims she saw this person doing something, and that's really all we had to go on. And we've covered on past episodes just how incredibly unreliable human memory is, and by extension, eyewitness testimony, but that's really all we had to go on for a while.
Yeah, and that continues through today. Like, I think the overall thesis today is that as a species, we're really bad at justice. Like, it's nowhere close to as random and almost hilarious as it used to be. And just for some background, like, I've got a little bit of history with this because I come from a family of law enforcement. I have multiple family members who are either local police or are federal police. Like, this is my background. I grew up among these people. And among that group, there was a more like conservative view that crime is rampant. Criminals constantly get away with it. You know, people with slick defense attorneys have all sorts of ways to get out of, you know, out of trouble. And we're just overwhelmed by crime and the civilization just barely hanging on. But then when I got out of college, I went to work for a law office briefly, as I had, was working as a producer at a TV station and a job that pays so little that I had a night job working at this law office doing their billing and that sort of thing.
You're kidding me. You worked in TV and you weren't like living in a mansion just raking it in?
Right.
Never heard of such a thing.
And they weren't a defense attorney, but they were more on that side of the equation. And that's where I learned how many people in jail get railroaded, and the more leftist point of view that the lower classes are constantly getting thrown in jail for either trumped up charges or on flimsy evidence, but the system is built to sort of not give them a chance at all. They're kind of forced into, you know, plea bargaining or that sort of thing. So people are constantly asking themselves, like, which is true? Like, which side of the equation is true? Are criminals constantly getting away with it, or are we constantly putting innocent people in jail? And the answer is they're both true.
Yeah.
Depending on the case.
Yeah. The statistic that you had sent was, I think that 35% of murders, nobody's convicted of them. They just don't get solved. And that's today with like DNA evidence and closed circuit cameras, you know, locking down all areas of any urban environment where people live. 35%, it's just like the cops are just like, I don't know, man. Your guess is as good as mine. And that's surprising to me. And now if we just run that back towards before the advent of DNA technology, before the advent of all the things we have today, all the types of physical evidence we have today, it must have been just a free-for-all. You could basically kill somebody if you wanted to. And like, I was doing the thought exercise of like, what must it have been like to live in that world, because the murder rate was crazy high. Before the 20th century, you were way, way, way more likely to die a violent death than you were in the 20th century, even with the advent of like atomic weapons and World War I and World War II. And I guess that kind of makes sense to me, because if there was somebody who I thought might want to harm me, going through the logic of it, I could either, you know, wait for them to try and defend myself, or try and get to them first, or move away with my family like a coward and like tell everybody that our name are the Johnsons now and we live like all the way over here, because they weren't going to get caught. Like, the police weren't going to help you.
Yeah, and just to set the stage, it's funny because we've had on the site, we've talked about how the Old West wasn't as violent as movies portray it. Simply because in the movies, they'll have a gunfighter who kills a dozen people at a time. And then you look at the actual records in the Old West and see that in these little mining towns, they may have only had two murders in a year. But that rate, even that, the true rate is much, much higher than what we had today. So, and not to bury people under numbers, because I know that when you're listening on audio, it's hard to digest a lot of statistics, but I'm going to try to lay out a few simple ones just to give you an idea. The murder rate in the USA right now is about 5 people per 100,000 per year. That's how we measure the murder rate. So just keep that number in mind. It's 5. I think it's like 4.8, something like that. In 1970, it was around 8. In the 90s, it was around 9, almost twice as high as it is now. And it's been falling since the 90s for a variety of reasons that experts don't completely understand. But the murder rate in the Old West, as best we can tell, is estimated to have been around 20 times higher. About 90 per 100,000 people per year. Now, again, in a small mining town with only 1,200 people, that still only equates to like half of a murder a year. But in the grand scheme of things, because you didn't have a metropolis with several million people back then, you know, the total number of murders was lower. But the percentage of, you know, your chances of being murdered back then were about 20 times higher.
The image we have in our head of the Old West that we were saying wasn't true was like
the shootouts. Like, one way to think about it is, like, the violence and murder was less organized. People didn't go into the center of town at high noon and shoot at each other until one of them was dead. That wasn't something that happened every time the clock struck noon. But there were murders for the same reason people kill each other today. It's just they probably happened when nobody was looking and they didn't get solved. But there was still violence.
Right. And when you think of the Old West, you would think of that as an especially violent period because it came with the advent of firearms that everyone had and that could be fired easily. You know, it wasn't like a musket that takes 20 minutes to load. They had six shooters that could fire multiple rounds very fast. You would think that it would be firearms that drew up that number. But when they've gone back to look at, like, pre-historical societies, like tribal societies before the advent of governments and that sort of thing, the bodies, about 15% of them show that they died violently. Skulls caved in. They died via some sort of weapon, either in warfare or whatever. That 15%, like today, it's much less than 1%. Again, even back before they had guns, when they were having to kill each other with their bare hands, with a club or with a stone, it was about, you know, 15 or 20 times more violent than it is today. And I think that gets back to what you're talking about, is because unless someone happened to see you do it, then there was almost no way to prosecute that person or to punish them. And, you know, they didn't have a prison system. And so when you go back and you look at, like, the biblical days and how much, you know, in the Bible, like, how much they emphasize the concept of God punishing people, it kind of casts new light on this idea of really driving home that there's always a witness. Like, really teaching these people, God is always watching. Because there aren't many other ways to convince somebody not to just, if somebody's bothering you, not to just kill them. Because, you know, even if they've got a family, like, they may have family members and friends who suspect you did it, but if you've got a, you know, if you can get rid of the body, if you can, there were so many ways to die back then, you know, that they would know that person didn't just get eaten by animals or whatever. It would be interesting to know what percentage of people, like, if you somehow had total knowledge of everything that ever happened, like, what percentage of people murdered and got away with it back then, and how many of them, like, didn't just because they believed in divine retribution or whatever. But the number has to be astronomical, like, even beyond what we have evidence for now.
Yeah, I think it's actually the oldest well-preserved human body was this mountain man that two hikers just stumbled on. They went off trail in, I think, Germany while they were, like, mountain climbing. And he had been, like, shot with three arrows. And that's the oldest well-preserved one we have, where we have evidence where we can say how specifically he died. But when you say 15%, like, they're talking about, like, you know, well, that skull is clearly, like, smashed in. There's a rock still in the skull, like, next right to the big hole in it. So, yeah, these are presumably fairly conservative estimates. And just going back to that mental exercise of, like, thinking about, okay, you commit a murder and the only way you get caught is if somebody saw you. If you are the witness of the murder, I don't know that I would necessarily report it, because first of all, you're getting yourself involved in a conflict with someone who you know is a murderer. And also, you pointed out that the thing in Game of Thrones, the, like, trial by battle, that's not a fiction that they made up. That used to actually be a practice, right?
Yeah, it was throughout the Middle Ages. As far as, I mean, I think they've got records for it going back to, like, I mean, I think there's a span of, like, 600 or 700 years in various parts of the world where they did this, trial by combat. Whereas if there wasn't a witness or there wasn't enough to go to have some sort of a jury decide it, they would just take the accused and the accuser and have them fight to the death. And the theory was, again, that the gods or God would see to it that the righteous person won, instead of the more obvious answer that the person who's better at murder,
right,
like, if you're really good at murder, it's like, damn, you know, the guy has all of the hallmarks of a murderer, but trial by combat again and again shows he's clearly innocent. Because he so effectively stabbed his accuser to death, he must be innocent of this stabbing he's accused of.
Right.
Because otherwise, how would he be so good at stabbing people during his trial? Surely God would intervene and take away the stabbing.
Amazingly, he used the same exact technique that person was murdered with to kill the person who had accused him in front of us all. That poor guy keeps getting accused of murder. The poor thing.
That's the point, is that they needed the public to feel like the right person got punished and that justice was done in an era when there was almost no other way to figure it out. Like, people have to understand, when you watch a cop show, all of the techniques they're using are very, very recent. It wasn't until like the late 1700s, early 1800s that they very, very first started to gather physical evidence. And I'm talking about studying the wounds on a person, you know, footprints, measuring footprints. You know, they had no cameras back then, or at least, you know, not until well into this period. That's extremely recent. And like you said, fingerprinting wouldn't come around until the early 1900s, and then would take a long time to filter out to the point that every department had access to it. You know, like when I say these things were invented, it was decades later that you had something like a database of fingerprints, probably the 1930s or 1940s, when you actually had something to compare them to. All of these basic, basic techniques. Even the process of, like, keeping track of a criminal's MO. You know, if you go back and, you know, like, read about, like, the Jack the Ripper case, things like that, the process of simply having files on hand of murder victims, similar causes of death, similar wounds, and saying, you know what, this is the same guy, that was recent. And before that, the amount of guesswork that went into it, again, unless it happened right in front of somebody, is mind-boggling. And then you have to surely get into what must have been people conspiring to accuse somebody of a crime.
Yeah.
Because if eyewitness testimony was all you had, then simply a gang of people getting together to accuse somebody was extremely easy. Because how do you exonerate yourself unless you have an equally impressive group of people giving you an alibi? That if the accusers are prominent people in town, and the accused is just some lowly beggar, why would they, like, it's open and shut.
Yeah, I think part of the thing that made me think about this was that in the same way that there's the snitches get stitches movement in the modern world, that probably was somewhat of the sort of ethos back at a time when it was really hard to prove. So you're leveling an accusation in a world where they're going to be like, okay, prove it. Like, if I witnessed a murder and I was that same cowardly version of myself, I'm having to totally fabricate this because, of course, I'm not a coward. I'm a courageous, violent hero. But if I saw someone kill someone, I would probably, just thinking completely rationally, why not accuse not the person you've seen who's willing to murder someone, but maybe just accuse the person you know who might try to murder you. Just like accuse someone who has a beef with you. That way you solve that problem, you get him out of the way, and you don't enrage the guy who is a murderer and probably wasn't going to get caught anyways. You know, when you hear these stories of like the witch trials and like people accusing other people of these crimes, you think of them as being these like, you know, hysterical, crazy, misguided, believing in spirits type of versions of historical people. But I can see a lot of ways in which in that version of history, when you paint a version of history that there's really no law or no reasonable way for anyone to be caught, where you're put in positions where the reasonable thing to do is a lot of the things that seem just horrifying and things that you tell yourself and can convince yourself in the modern world you would never do. By the way, I want to come back to fingerprinting because I had always thought that fingerprinting was an exact science. It was like, if they find your fingerprints at the scene, you were there, you did it. And now that we have DNA evidence, there's a lot of legal experts who are now like, look, so fingerprints actually aren't that good. They were just the best thing we had to go on. And they're arguing that they shouldn't be admissible in court cases now. It's like they were bluffing about them being an exact science before.
All of this that we're going to dig into, a lot of the justice system, a lot of it is sort of theater. You know, for instance, polygraph tests, so-called lie detector tests, were all the rage for a long time when the people who used the machines, who administered the tests, always knew that they're not accurate. They don't detect lies. Obviously, the machine's not omniscient. It doesn't know if you're lying. It detects nervousness. But they were very good at getting people to confess. Because if you could, you know, you get a person hooked up to the thing and they get nervous and they think the machine's all powerful. And so they're now motivated to fold under pressure or whatever. In other words, a very stupid person will go ahead and confess because they're scared of the machine. Lots of what we tried over time comes down to superstition and trying to appeal to people's sense of guilt. Or like I said, so much of, you talked about like the witch trials, so much of it is not even religious, but it's superstitious in nature, that it's trying to scare people into confessing, guilt people into, like trying to build into them that even if we can't catch you doing it, that you still need to come forward and make it right, that your own conscience will torture you. And it's almost a system that works very well if the person is a decent, normal person. If the person's a sociopath, they're going to skate, which is one reason why sociopaths still thrive in society, because they're that one group of people who you can't guilt into. Like, their only fear is getting caught. Their actions don't weigh on them. That's what a sociopath is. So we have a lot of things, even today, that we'll get into that are there. They're very impressive looking. A courtroom is a very impressive looking spectacle. The jury, 12 people there to judge you, like it's all very scary. And so a young and dumb defendant would feel enough of a sense of awe that they would hopefully come around and say, you know what, I did, because they're scared of the system. But a lot of it is kind of in place to hide the fact that we really still don't know what we're doing.
I mean, it's still a jury. It's still a group of average people. And this book that I just read, Unfair, by author named to be inserted later, talks about how any sense we have, like if you're having a hard time thinking about what Jason means when he says, like, we still have superstitions that determine things, anything you've ever heard that is an indicator of whether someone's lying, like they seem nervous, they look up and to one direction or another, those are all basically folk wisdom. They're superstition. And when you ask juries and people who've served on juries, like, what were you thinking? They're consulting these things that are essentially folk wisdom and that lawyers know about and coach out of anybody appearing in court or any witness. They're coached to do this. So it really is lawyers teaching people how to act in this sort of theatrical display meant to convince people who are consulting a bunch of sort of folk wisdom. The author's name, by the way, is Adam Benferrato. It's a really great book. People should check it out. Unfair, The New Science of Criminal Injustice.
Yeah, I learned a game from William Wesley. You can never check me. Back to back for the niggas that didn't get the message. Back to back like I'm on the cover of Lethal Weapon. Back to back like I'm Jordan 96, 97. Whoa, very important and very pretentious. When I look back, I might be mad that I gave this attention. Yeah, but it's weighing heavy on my conscience.
Hey guys, we're riding into the ads this week on the back of Drake's Back to Back, which is kind of being hailed as the definitive knockout punch in his feud with the rapper Meek Mill, who accused him of using a ghostwriter. I think it's at least the death knell for the conventional wisdom I had heard quoted in the past few years that you should never beef down. Most people didn't know who Meek Mill was before this beef, and now they know him as the guy Drake destroys in that song that has been at number one on iTunes all week. Anyways, felt appropriate to this week's episode. This is what we have these days instead of dueling with pistols, which, as we've covered on the site, and it's probably worth mentioning here again in the context of this episode, was a shockingly common way to settle problems in history. If you were a male, every day you woke up just knowing there was a chance you would piss someone off so much they'd challenge you to a one-on-one murder contest with guns, and your social standing would be totally ruined if you said no. Andrew Jackson, the president, had like a Mayweather-esque record when it came to duels. Yeah, the guy on the 20 murdered his way onto the 20. History was no joke. Neither is Drake in this song. This is what we have instead of dueling, hopefully. Meek Mill, Please Don't Murder Drake. Thanks, man. All right, now some words from our sponsors.
You love her, then you gotta get a world tour. Is that a world tour or your girl's tour? I know that you gotta be a thug for her. This ain't what she meant when she told you to open up more. Yeah, trigger fingers turn to Twitter fingers. Yeah, you getting bodied by a singing nigga. I'm not the type of nigga that a type of niggas. And shout to all my boss, bitches, wife, and niggas.
Once again, guys, this week's episode is being sponsored by Lynda.com. Look, it's August, we're in the dog days of summer. The only things on television are NCIS reruns and some sport called baseball. Why not use this time to find a new passion or get better at an existing one on Lynda.com? Lynda offers 3,000 courses on a wide array of topics, from web development and design to business and software training. And they're adding new courses every week. And here's what's important. All of these courses are taught by real experts. They're not some kid on YouTube who's telling you how he thinks to do something or telling you how to do it intentionally wrong. There's that YouTube channel called Pronunciation Guide. This is how they say to pronounce shrimp.
So shrinipa.
And here's their pronunciation guide for Frappuccino. Those aren't correct, you guys. As you probably know, it's a joke. It's a very funny joke. But fact is, you can't always trust the lessons that you find just by Googling or finding a video on YouTube. Anyways, Lynda teaches you how to actually do things and how to do them better. And as an added bonus, they just have a really incredibly easy website to use. Like, you can sort by anything. If you want to sort by skill type that you're trying to learn, or say you want to start learning how to edit videos, or maybe you only know how to use Adobe Premiere but want to learn Final Cut Pro, Lynda will sort that in the easiest way possible for you to find and learn the exact skill that you want to learn. So do something good for yourself this summer, guys. Sign up for a free 10-day trial by visiting lynda.com/cracked, and you get access to their whole library, which is 3,000 courses, and you can access it from desktop, iOS, Android devices. Even if you learn one thing, it'll be worth it. So give Lynda a try. That's lynda.com/cracked. Today's show is also being brought to you by Casper Mattresses. So let's compare how much we sleep versus how much we drive, say. We sleep for a third of our lives. And if you're anything like me, or if you're exactly like our engineer Brett, you got one mattress right after you graduated college, and the only way you're going to get a new one before you die is if you get married. And it's not looking good for engineer Brett, I'm just telling you. On the other hand, we only drive 7% of our lives, but every 5 or 10 years, we pay 20, 30, 40, in my case, hundreds of thousands of dollars on every new car. And that's insane. Why not invest in an amazing mattress at a shockingly fair price? That sounds like a good idea. Casper Mattresses are where it's at, you guys. They sent me one, and I've been sleeping like a baby who doesn't wake up at night, or like an old man who's very drunk ever since I got it. And the reason they're so comfortable is because they bring together two technologies, latex foam and memory foam. So their mattresses have just the right sink, just the right bounce. They also have a 100-day risk-free return policy and deliver it straight to you. And if you're not feeling it after 3 months, they just pick it back up. They make it so easy and make just a great product. The mattresses start at just $500 for a twin. They go up to $950 for a king. And they've got everything in between, and those are actually incredible prices. If you're not actively pricing mattresses, that is really the best price you're going to find. And even better news, you can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/cracked and using offer code cracked. Once again, that's casper.com/cracked and use the offer code cracked.
I don't want to hear about the Sever again. Not even when she tell them that they better as friends. Not even when you're saying Drizzy, tell him again. I've been putting on the show, it was a sellout event. Oh, you need better seating. I didn't want to do it, gave me every reason. The point I'm trying to make is I don't ever need him. Seeing what you do for fame or what you do for freedom.
I'm going to run a few more numbers by people just to give you an idea of what we're referencing here, if it seems like we're being too critical. Jack said earlier that right now 35% of murders go unsolved, meaning the police don't make an arrest, period. That other 65% that gets solved, like, That's just the ones where they made an arrest. That's not counting the people who then got off at trial. So of the 65% where they arrest somebody, they usually do get convicted. In federal cases, the conviction rate they boast is over 90%. In the state level, it's lower, but I still think it's about 75%. It depends on the jurisdiction. But the point is, once they arrest you, there's a very, very high chance you're gonna go to jail. One of the reasons that 35% number is so high is they're not going to arrest you until they've got enough evidence. There's a lot of murders where they're pretty sure they know who did it. You know, this gang member got killed, well known that he had a beef with this other gang member. But if nobody's willing to testify, then it's nobody's ever going to get arrested. They just won't. So that goes down in the unsolved pile, even though the cops think they know who did it. Of that 75 to 95% that get convicted, 95% of them pled guilty. Usually through a plea bargain, because the prosecutor comes to you and says, okay, if we go to trial, we're going to go for life. If you plea, you will give you 20 years, you'll be out in 10 with good behavior, you'll still be young enough to start a family, whatever. So very, very few of these cases actually go to trial like you see on TV, where there's witnesses and the judge and all that. Like, there's only a few hundred murder trials a year, even though in the USA, I think there's something like 15,000 murders a year. Only a tiny fraction of those go to trial if you just do the math. If you cut it down to the 65% that result in an arrest, and then of those, the percent that, you know, the 5% that don't plea out, there's not that many that murder trials. Otherwise, we would all constantly be in jury duty because there'd just be 100 trials a week in every city you live in. And it's not like that. Most of the time, they plead out. They are so good at getting these pleas from people that a certain percentage of the time, they're getting guilty pleas from people that did not actually commit the murder. These innocence projects were where they will come back, you've heard about, they'll come back years later and gather DNA evidence. And then in something like 300 in some cases, they've exonerated people that have been found guilty by finding DNA that proved they weren't even there. Like, the real murderer's DNA was all over the scene, but it just didn't get tested at the time. In something like 10% of those cases, the people had pled guilty to a murder they didn't commit because their own lawyer and the prosecutor both sat down with them and said, look, if this goes to trial, you're going to lose. We've got two witnesses that say you did it. If you take the plea bargain, you'll be out an X number of years. You'll still be a young man. You can still have a life. So it was actually advantageous to them to take the plea bargain and plead guilty to something they didn't do, because the prosecution basically built an overwhelming case regardless, and all they had on their end was a public defender. This is why I had said that earlier that the thing about, you know, bad guys go free all the time and innocent people go to jail all the time, that those are both true, because you look at a case like O.J. Simpson's and you say, oh gosh, that's disgusting. The guy, you know, was rich enough to get away with murder because he had this dream team of lawyers who was able to pick apart every piece of the prosecution's evidence. In a perfect world, everybody would have that. Because the reality is, the case they had against O.J. wasn't strong. They didn't have a murder weapon. They didn't have a witness. All they had was a bunch of circumstantial evidence that implied he had been at the scene, but the scene was his ex-wife's house. He had been there hundreds of times. So if that same case had been brought against some young kid from the inner city, he would have been convicted in days, or most likely would never have gone to trial. Because a prosecutor would have sat down and said, oh, we've got blood, and we've got DNA, and we've got hair, and footprints, and da-da-da-da, and you've got no chance. And they would have made him a deal, and he would have pled out. Whereas once you've got a real legal team, and the same thing with the Robert Durst case we discussed on a previous podcast that I know a lot of people weren't following, but it was a similar deal. A very wealthy man basically got off from a crime that it looked like it was obvious he committed. And you get disgusted by that because it's like, God, this murderer walked free just because he had money. But the truth is, all that happened was he had competent legal counsel that was able to hold the prosecution's feet to the fire and say, look, if you can't produce a witness, if you can't produce, like, beyond reasonable doubt that this guy did it, then no, you don't get to take away his freedom. You don't get to put him to death.
Yeah. The thing about the confession, I think, is really hard for people to get their mind around. Pleading guilty, or a lot of the people who have been freed due to DNA evidence that it had been someone else and not them, had signed confessions. The police had interrogated them and they had signed confessions. And I had always been like, they must be like doing some weird form of brainwashing. And there is that, the interrogation strategy that's been in use for the past, I don't know, 50 years is essentially a system for getting someone to say the thing you want them to say. It starts with the assumption that the person they're interrogating is guilty and tries to move from where they are in the conversation to that person signing a confession. It's not based on trying to find out the facts of what happened. But I think the podcast Serial actually made me understand this, because if you haven't heard it, it's the story of this kid who's in jail and may or may not have done it, but there's a lot of stuff that seems to suggest that he might not have. But the really infuriating thing is that he didn't seem to, during his trial, advocate for himself, and his lawyer did a shitty job. And when you hear interviews with him, there's just this sort of sense that, well, I'm innocent, so I have nothing to be worried about. And that's something that experts say is often the cause of people signing confessions, is the cops are, you know, hammering you with this technique designed to get you to say this one thing they want you to say, and they keep you up all night and haven't given you any food, and, you know, you just want to sleep, and they're saying, just sign this confession and you can go home, or, you know, they're making all these promises, it'll be much easier for you. And people think, well, obviously I didn't do it, so I'm just going to sign the confession and things will work out later. They'll find the DNA evidence, you know, they'll be able to prove that it wasn't me. But there's this story in that book, Unfair, where this guy kept getting convicted of the same crime even after a third trial happened where there was DNA evidence. It was a murder and sexual assault. There's DNA evidence that it wasn't his DNA. It was an 11-year-old victim. And the prosecution's only argument was, well, she might have had sex with someone else earlier that night, and that's why the DNA doesn't match. This 11-year-old girl, that's what they had to resort to. And he got convicted every time, because the jury was like, well, he signed a confession. He said he did it. And like, that is the most damning thing. Like, it's almost like justice as a concept works really well. Like, believing that there is justice works really well for guilty people and like really screws over innocent people. Like, whether it's like the Middle Ages or modern day, there's a lot of people whose lives have been ended or ruined by the thought, well, bad things don't happen to good people, and like the truth will out eventually. That's just not the case. That's like a false understanding of how the system actually works.
Yeah, and not to recap the contents of a much, much more popular podcast, but I would recommend anyone go back and listen to the episodes of Serial, because it's extremely well done. It's extremely good at bringing you into the situation and explaining the process and how it works in a way that's it's a lot of fun. As horrible as the subject matter is, it's very entertaining, is what I mean to say. But to summarize, what had happened was, it's a case that was about 15 years ago of a guy that went to jail, got a life sentence for murdering his high school girlfriend. And his trial was very quick and easy. The jury didn't deliberate long, returned a life sentence. Against this guy, they had no physical evidence, no DNA, no witness to the crime itself, no indication of that he was violent toward her or anything of the sort, no threats, nothing else to indicate he had done it. All they had, the prosecution's case, 100% of their case, was they had a guy who came forward and said, I helped this guy bury the body. There was an acquaintance of his who was a drug dealer, and said he came to me because I was like the only criminal he knew, and he showed me this person, this body in his trunk, and I helped him bury it. Then they had some cell phone records that showed that his phone was in the region where the body was buried that day, but it's a large area. There's like an antenna a few miles away. Like, that was it.
And there's been subsequent reporting on that that says that cell phone records actually don't say what the prosecution said they did at that time. And it's since been, nobody is allowed to use cell phone records anymore as a indication of locating where someone was, because it just represents a fundamental misunderstanding of how cellular technology works. But they spend a whole episode of Serial, which I'm just going to say, it's not as good as this podcast. You can just listen to us talk about it. You don't need to go listen to that.
This one witness that the prosecution had, the police, when they brought him in, coached him for several hours before they turned on the tape recorder and had him tell his story. He told the story three different times and told it different three different times, including key things such as where he was when the guy showed him the body. Like, once said he was in the parking lot of a Best Buy, another time said that he was like out
at his grandma's house.
Like, these are not minor differences. He said that the guy called him from a payphone. They looked, it turned out there had never been a payphone in that location. Like, his story was very fishy, and that's after the police sat down with him. And for, I think it was like 2 hours, they met with him before turning on the tape recorder to say, okay, tell us the story. And it was clear they were going over it and over it and over it, getting, basically coaching this guy on what story to tell. So when you hear this and you think they put a guy in prison for life based on that, the testimony of this one shady guy with nothing else, and they interviewed person after person, former, you know, police, former prosecutors, who all said, oh, that's typical. Like, for a murder case, this is actually pretty strong. Because the whole issue is there was never another strong suspect. There was no one else, you know, seen with her that day. There was no one else who really had all, you know, the motive and opportunity, all these things. So the fact that really it's only this guy, the fact that he was around that day and couldn't prove where he was. He claimed he was at track practice after school. The track practice coach says, I don't remember if he was there or not, because it was months later before they interviewed the guy. So therefore he didn't have himself on camera somewhere. You know, the point is, can you prove where you were 6 weeks ago or 8 weeks ago? Probably not. You can guess where you probably were. Like, you'd say, well, if it was during the day, I was probably at work. But you often can't prove it, and this guy couldn't either. And then they had this one witness telling a very detailed story, and that was enough for the jury. And those last three words are everything. For the jury. Can you tell a compelling story that 12 random people, not experts, randomly selected people will believe? And because they had this witness who was very articulate, had a very detailed story talking about how shallow the grave was, described what the body would look like when they found it, took police right to the body, that was enough. And in many, many cases, even of people on death row, one witness might be all they have. But if you go into it knowing where even the public defender is telling you, look, what they've got is enough to convict. I don't want to hear you tell me how innocent you are. I'm telling you what they've got is enough to convict. If you plead out, you'll avoid the death penalty, or you'll avoid life, or whatever. And in fact, that's how this guy wound up with life, because he kept pushing the case, insisting, I'm innocent, I'm innocent. He would not plea out. And I don't know if he did it or not. That's one reason why Serial is so compelling, because at the end of it, you just don't know. The guy is very earnest in the way he defends himself. But then again, every other alternate theory falls through. Like, he did have opportunity. Like, the guy who was the witness for the prosecution, he had an alibi for the actual crime itself. Like, they know he apparently wasn't the one that did it. So barring some stranger, like a serial killer passing through the city and doing it and then disappearing without a trace, the defense was never able to pose like an alternate theory, which is what you sometimes have to do, even though that's not what the law says you have to do. The law says you're innocent until proven guilty. But because they couldn't really cast blame elsewhere, that was that.
One of the stories that I read in this book, Unfair, about eyewitness testimony that blew my mind was one of the people who was freed by the Innocence Project had been identified by an eyewitness. He was convicted of raping an elderly woman and, you know, not wearing a mask. And she picked him out of a lineup and then identified him in court. That's as airtight as you can get. That's as memorable and, like, reliable of an eyewitness as you can really imagine. Like, of course, she's going to remember exactly what the person looked like. But not only did it turn out that her memory had been incorrect and screwed up, but it happened to be that when they did the lineup, they had the actual perpetrator in the lineup just as a filler because they had just picked him up on some other charge. So she had picked the wrong guy over the right guy in a lineup. So the cops had zeroed in on this guy, the one who didn't do it, as a suspect. And then they had shown her a picture of him earlier that day. So her mind was already like familiar with his face. And then there are all sorts of sort of subtle things that the cops can do during a lineup to get you to tell you who they want you to pick. That's one of those things that if you listened to the Serial podcast story of that crime before DNA evidence, you would be like, well, yeah, of course this guy's guilty. What is he talking about? He's innocent. And even to that degree, there's like so many ways that things can just get screwed up. And the other person who I had always had confidence in a courtroom as like representing the case of justice is the judge. And there was this study of Israeli, I've talked about this before, but it bears repeating, a study of Israeli parole board judges, like judges who determine whether or not somebody who's up for parole should be freed, found that the number one factor that determined whether or not someone got their parole approved was when in the day the judge reviewed it. If the judge did it early in the morning, there was like a 25% chance. If the judge did it right before lunch, so he was low on energy, there was a 0% chance. And, you know, the judges, and I think even the scientists, were looking at it to see like if they had biases or, you know, all these different factors that they assumed might prejudice judges against these parole inquiries. And the main thing that they found was just time of day was the number one thing. Just think about that. Like, if you're wrongly accused of a crime, like, you're going into this thing where just it's random chance if you get convicted or not.
Yeah, and it's just because of the human element there. Some people might think it's kind of crazy we've gotten this far into the conversation without mentioning race and the fact that by every measure, black people get it worse in the justice system. Like, for the same crimes, they get harsher sentences, they got, you know, guilty verdicts returned more often. And that's not due to a conspiracy among white people to try to put black people in jail, although it maybe to some degree it is. But even among jurors who under oath would swear, even under a lie detector test, would swear that they're not racist, still have these unconscious biases. Even black jurors looking at fellow black people as defendants will more likely to call them guilty because you're relying on, well, he just seems guilty to me. There's something about him I can't quite put my finger on it that makes him seem like the type of guy who would do this. And I don't even know, like, they wouldn't know it's racism, but it's a lifetime of seeing black criminals and black people portrayed as criminals. And it just, he looks like the type of guy who would do it. And I think if you could hear the transcript of what juries say to each other in the jury box, the arguments they have before they finally arrive at a guilty or non-guilty verdict, I think everyone would be mortified at how like arbitrary and ridiculous. And we had a case on the site we mentioned where they had the jury got caught using like a Ouija board. They're trying to summon like the spirit of the deceased. And because so often like they'll literally in the jury box reference like TV shows they've seen. Or we've talked about like the CSI effect. It's like, well, why isn't there any DNA evidence? Why isn't, if this person's so guilty, because they're going by a TV show where if you did it, then that means that in the police station, they've got like a hologram that like on bones, like a crime solving laser that detects if you were ever at the scene. And in real life, you don't have that.
Yeah, we talked to a person who works for the equivalent of what you see in the CSI TV show. And the equipment they have is just so shitty, like to the point that they have to provide their own, I think it was fingerprint powder. They wouldn't even like buy that for them. The police wouldn't. Yeah, it's not a very exact science. And I think people know that, like, okay, racist jury, like that's where our mind goes when we think of wrongly convicted black people. But there are hundreds of decisions being made along the way, whether it's the woman picks out a different suspect, and then the cop says, well, now we have all afternoon, take your time, telling her in a subtle way, like, you've picked the wrong person, pick again. Or, you know, there's so many different things along the way where decisions made by people who aren't consciously being racist, they're mistakes. But because it's in an inexact science, it's almost like the fears and prejudices of people, and they might not even be consciously making these decisions, but their fears and prejudices get manifested in who goes to jail, because there's hundreds of decisions being made by humans along the way that can make someone look guilty when they really aren't. And it's not just like a 12 Angry Man racism case a lot of the time. Like, there's a lot of decisions up the chain that brought that person there that might be a reflection of someone who doesn't consciously think, well, I'm racist, I'm going to wrongly convict this person. But, you know, because of cultural conditioning, they have these unconscious biases that they don't realize. And it's like the justice system is just more of a reflection of sort of culturally held beliefs than it is a reflection of like who's actually committing all these crimes. One of the stats that I heard, and yeah, I wanted to get around to the ways that this disadvantages Black Americans, is that there are more African American men in prison, jail, or on probation or parole than were enslaved in 1850. That's insane to me.
What you said about the police like subtly cueing the witness to pick out the right person out of the lineup, that makes it sound again like the police have a conspiracy to convict certain people or to try to nail innocent people. Again, I have a heavy bias toward police because I know so many of them and their family members, and I believe that the vast majority of police are good and try very hard. It's a high-stress job. It's difficult to get right.
You're a narc. It's okay. You can come out and say it. Jason's a narc. Yeah.
What you're talking about there, and this came up in the O.J. Simpson trial, police early on in most cases, I think generally are pretty sure they know who did it. Wife dies, they're pretty sure the husband did it. He's a scumbag. They've been there, you know, maybe he's got a history of domestic abuse. So their investigation is not a whodunit. It's gathering enough evidence for the prosecution to take it to trial. And this is, if there's anyone listening to this who wants to get away with murder and you're thinking about murdering someone, some good advice I can give you. Your job is not to confuse the police. It doesn't matter if the police know, quote unquote, you did it. Your job is to make sure they don't have enough evidence to take to trial. That's why if you get rid of the body, there's no murder, because that person could still be alive. They will not charge you. There's no body, there's no crime. And in OJ's case, he successfully got rid of the murder. I'm speaking as if OJ did it, which I'm fairly sure. But he got rid of the murder weapon, somehow managed to not get seen doing it, even though he did it in broad daylight. That was enough. If you've got competent lawyers, that was enough. The thing that they accused the cops of faking during the trial, of what you dropping the bloody glove at the scene where the whole theory was that Mark Furman probably threw that in the yard. They recovered the glove from elsewhere and he threw it in the yard just to try to seal the door on OJ. That wasn't because he was a racist and wanted to put a famous Black man in jail. It was because he and all the other cops were sure OJ did it, but also knew they didn't have enough to take it to trial, or at least to win at trial, because it was all of this circumstantial crap. Because again, his blood stain at the scene only means he was there at some point. That doesn't mean he murdered somebody. His shoe print at the scene only means he was there at some point. Doesn't mean he murdered anybody. That's what circumstantial evidence is. Without a witness to tie it together, it's just evidence that you were at your ex-wife's house at some point, which he would freely admit. So what he had done was what I think when you talk about corrupt police or police framing people, the vast, vast, vast majority of the time is they are framing a guilty person. You throw the glove in the yard so you can get them in the interrogation room, show them the glove in a little evidence bag and say, this is your glove, you own it, it's covered in your blood, we found it 10 feet away from the body, confess. If you go to trial, it's going to be much worse for you. This glove is proof we have everything we need. Now, in OJ's case, he had a dream team of lawyers who could counter that. That would have worked in a lesser case. And in cases where they're fudging evidence or fudging witness testimony, maybe coaching a witness, That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to get that plea bargain out of somebody. And what you're talking about with the high incarceration rate of blacks, like, you can't separate race from class in this country. The truth is that if you are lower income, lower education, unemployed, whatever, you're far, far, far more likely to go to jail. And it just so happens, due to decades of racism, that most of those people are minorities. So whether it's because the jury is racist or because the system simply forces a lot of members of a certain race into an underclass that tends to commit a lot of crimes, it doesn't matter. It comes to the same thing. That disproportionately, a millionaire like O.J. Simpson, who happens to be black, like, his race was less relevant there because he had the money to afford good attorneys who could pick apart each part of the prosecution's case. A lesser person who's dealing, their only defense is an overworked defense attorney, they would have just gotten steamrolled by that, even if they hadn't done it. And that's the difference, is that, and, you know, and we're using like high profile murder cases as our examples, when most of the time it's not that. Like, the routine cases, it's just not that hard. If it's not just an unsolvable, there's a body in the street, nobody's talking, you know, one of that 35% where there's not even anybody to arrest. If it's a case where they're able to make an arrest, usually it's a slam dunk, because the person being accused, once the police decide they did it, they can usually bring that home and get them put in jail, whether they did it or not. And it kind of comes down to what kind of a defense you can mount.
And there's just so much evidence that people are wrong a lot of the time. The cops have a suspect and they're going to work until that suspect is convicted. And sometimes their gut's right, but a lot of times it's wrong too. And, you know, once DNA evidence became a thing, they were able to free a lot of people who the cops were 100% certain did it, and probably did some things, made some decisions that could have gone either way in such a way as to get a conviction. Now, here's the thing that blew my fucking mind, is that we've been talking about DNA evidence as like, well, now we have DNA evidence and that's like the end all be all. He talks about in this book, Unfair, a experiment where they had forensic scientists evaluate a sample from a gang rape. And in one of the cases, they were just told, okay, see if you can find this person's DNA in this sample. No context, just it was one of many things they were trying to match it up with. And only two of the forensic experts found a match. I think one or two. When they told them, okay, this is a sample from a gang rape and this person was probably involved, the cops are reasonably certain, it was like 16 of the 17 found the sample. So even DNA evidence can be subjective. And, you know, we talked to someone who works in a forensics lab who, I forget what state they were from, but their state makes it so that every single sample that they evaluate is a double blind test where they have no influence. But in a lot of places, it turns out that's not the case. You can be told by the cops, okay, we're pretty sure this guy's guilty. Do you see his DNA anywhere in here? And I don't know if it's exactly that stupid, but you know, that's shocking to me though, that even DNA evidence can be somewhat subjective.
Well, and even worse than that, because again, the DNA evidence, like if the DNA completely clears someone, like it absolutely doesn't match theirs at all, then it's very useful for like eliminating somebody. But otherwise, again, it just comes down to, can you convince a jury with it? So does your DNA expert, is he able to phrase it in a certain way that makes it sound like, oh, it's 99% this person? Like the chances of it being another person is like 1 in 8 million. Like, are they able to express the numbers in a way that convinces a jury? Whereas in the OJ trial, they were able to do the opposite. They were able to get the prosecution's DNA expert up there and get him to admit that, well, no, actually, there's 3,000 people in Los Angeles alone that have a similar DNA strand. Like they were able to take the exact same numbers and reverse them to say, but this is not O.J. Simpson's DNA. This is consistent with his DNA, but there's also other human beings. So again, just through talking through it and presenting it a certain way, they were able to render that unconvincing evidence, where in another case, they could have made that sound like, oh yeah, it says DNA, as if the DNA has your name printed on it, like it's a name tag, which of course it's not. But again, when we talk about like how much of this is theater, it comes down to convincing the jury to return a guilty verdict.
I don't want it to seem like I'm saying the Innocence Project is falsely getting people freed, because anytime that they're coming with DNA evidence that someone didn't do it, it's really hard to get a conviction overturned. You're not only having to say this DNA is inconsistent with the suspect who was convicted's DNA, you're also usually having to find a match with another person, and it needs to be like a 100% difference. Like, it's not a thing where you're just, it could go either way, and so they let the person go. When you're getting someone freed, it's like almost 100% black and white case. But in terms of the convicting process, it seems like intentionality still comes into play quite a bit. And when intentionality is involved, then you are getting all the biases, all the prejudices that people have involved in what actually happens, whether someone is deemed guilty or innocent.
Yeah, and I can't emphasize that enough. Like at trial, you know, they give the jury all sorts of instructions that the prosecution has to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt. Upon appeal, it's almost 100% the opposite. Like, you've got to prove that something huge got missed in your case. Like, you have to prove that you didn't get a fair trial because some big piece of exonerating evidence. And even then, like, it's up to the judgment of a judge whether or not to allow you to try again or whatever. Like, when we say that they've had 300 and some people exonerated on murder charges, like, that's incredible that they were able to meet that standard in that many cases, because there were so many others where they're pretty sure they didn't do it, but they can't overcome that almost impossibly high barrier of proving that somebody else did. Because again, as a society, it's so important for us to believe that in general, bad people get what they deserve and good people go free. Like, we need to believe in this. We need to believe that the universe is just. And that attorney that I worked for out of school, she was a big anti-death penalty advocate. And that's so incredibly difficult to get support for, because you are basically out there defending murderers or people accused of murder, people accused of multiple rapes and murders. Well, in many cases, the person you're trying to get off from the death penalty, they're someone who was a rapist but wasn't a murderer. Like, they had, you know, they had terrible crimes on their record. It's just that it really looks like they didn't commit this one. And in fact, they only got picked up because they were an easy subject to, like, to throw in front of the jury. Say, look at this scumbag. Got it. You know, isn't this the type of thing he would do? And so, it, you know, they're a target that's very unlovable and very easy, like very difficult for the defense to get the jury to sympathize with. And those are the people that are easiest to convict of all. And, you know, from the police point of view, it's like, well, if he didn't do this, he did something. Like, you don't even feel bad about, like, even if you didn't get the right guy, like, he's probably killed people that we didn't catch him for, so it all works out. She actually changed my mind about the death penalty because, again, I've been raised in this very conservative in the sense that it's very law and order based. Like, I grew up believing that the number one problem facing America was crime, criminals, people who didn't take responsibility for themselves, and that it's all about, you know, law and order, being tough on crime and all that stuff. Like, that shaped my worldview. And her point of view was that if you're politically a conservative person, you think the government's incompetent at everything they do. How can you trust them to get this right? Like, this is the one thing you can't take back. You know, you kill the person, you find out a month later you had it wrong, you can't resurrect them. Like, so how can you give the government this ability to take a life when we know how sloppy this process is? And that had convinced me. It's like, I still believe that in the grand scheme of things, there are people that deserve to die for what they did, but it's so rare that you 100%, like even O.J. Simpson, I'm not 100%. Like, if you put me in charge of pulling the lever to put him to death, I couldn't do that. Like, I don't, there's always some oddball chance that maybe he knew who did it or something weird. Maybe yeah. He was associated with them.
I definitely think he deserves like an asterisk next to his name in the Football Hall of Fame. Yeah, I mean, that's important. It would be easy for me to listen to this conversation and think, but what's the alternative? We just don't have a criminal justice system. And I think the thing to keep in mind is that America's justice system punishes with biblical certainty. Our jail terms are longer. We put people in jail more quickly and for offenses that would be considered ticky-tack overseas and like get you fined. We have the harshest punishments, and I guess I always assumed that was warranted by a justice system that had some certainty about what they were doing, and it's really shockingly not the case. Like, one of the things that this book focuses on is that, you know, while the death penalty is relatively rare, there's tons of people being put in solitary confinement in prisons. We have by far the highest population of any country living in prison right now. And solitary confinement's a thing that's being brought back, something that has had a resurgence in popularity inside jails. And when you hear John McCain talk about when he was a prisoner of war in Vietnam, he says by far the worst part of the torture, it wasn't the physical torture, it was that they kept me in solitary confinement for 2 years. That's actual, literal, like, mental torture. It's one of the worst things that can happen to a human being for their development and for their mental state. And when you take into account that a lot of people in prison have mental disabilities or, you know, mental illness to begin with or substance abuse, you're doing almost the worst possible thing you could to rehabilitate that person. You're torturing them. And it really literally is torture, but we do it, and based on a system that seems shockingly fallible.
Right. And if you come out and try to make the argument that it's cruel or unusual, then the vast, vast majority of people will respond, well, you should say that to the victims' families. You know, it's even more cruel to get murdered, to get raped, or to get, like, describe what these people did. And that's the thing. Any effort to reform the system is met by a brick wall of, we are very big in this country on getting revenge on criminals. And I'm convinced that this is a Christianity thing, because Christianity is based on, you forgive and forgive and forgive your enemies, but at some point you put them in hell forever. Like, we are tolerant, but the moment our tolerance runs out, you die. You know, in the Bible, in the Old Testament, they had the death penalty for everything, from drunkenness to adultery to take your pick. Violent deaths. They would throw giant stones at you until you were bludgeoned to death with stones. Like, and that was not portrayed as a bad thing at all. Like, this was God personally telling them, stone this person to death because of homosexuality, because of whatever they did. And that's still kind of in our DNA, that if you're a good person, the way you prove your goodness is being intolerant of evil. And the way you are intolerant of evil is by inflicting as much pain as possible on the bad guys. And despite the fact that you have an entire New Testament that's based around forgiveness, the book of Revelation, the Bible, ends on this final climax where all of the bad people have their faces melted, like at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. The Old Testament God comes back at the end, and there is no more forgiveness. There are no more second chances. There's no more reforming people. All of the bad people are burned because that's what they deserve. So I'm going to run a few numbers by you because, and again, I know that numbers sort of wash over people, but you said America has more prisoners than anybody else. We have about 2.5 million people in some sort of jail, prison, county jail, something. That's, so it's about 1% of the population, right? 1 out of every 100 people's in jail. There's another 5 million on parole. So we're very big about jail as the place to put bad people. But of the people in jail, about 20% of them have a serious mental illness. We're talking schizophrenia, we're talking autism, we're talking serious. If you throw in what are considered less serious mental illnesses, things like depression, anxiety disorders, post-traumatic stress disorder, things like that are a little bit harder to diagnose, the estimates go up to maybe half of the inmates have something like that wrong with them. An astounding 85% of prisoners have substance abuse issues, either now or in the past. they're either addicts now to alcohol, drugs, something or whatever, or else they have a history with it. Drugs or alcohol are involved in 80% of violent crimes and property crimes both. Means lots of people are in jail because they stole things to sell for drugs, or they were selling drugs, or they got high or drunk and they beat up their wife, or they got high or drunk and got in a fight at a bar and killed somebody. They were under the influence of something. In other words, our prison system is the single biggest holder of the mentally ill and substance abuse users. And if you consider substance abuse to be a mental illness, which is very easy to make the case that it is, then this is where we put all of these people. Because our system is, because we don't really have asylums anymore where we just take people and put them in there once they show that they can't take care of themselves. We basically just sit back, wait for them to commit a crime, and then throw them in prison. So if you've got somebody who has a mental illness that they are self-medicating for, such as drinking to try to relieve anxiety issues, or smoking marijuana to try to relieve anxiety issues, or to relieve insomnia, or they're doing cocaine to whatever, trying to replace something in their brain, trying to fight depression, whatever, you can now arrest them for having the drugs. You can arrest them for doing whatever they do to get money for the drugs. Like, these crimes that stem from their brain problems have filled the prisons.
And prisons, by the way, that's what we're doing to prevent crimes. Prisons are places that have enormous crime rates inside of them and enormous drug abuse rates. The whole don't drop the soap joke and stuff like that. There is a lot of sexual assault in prisons, and a lot of times it is the people who have mental disabilities or are the smallest people and are first-time offenders who get that. It's not like the worst killers are targeted by the people who sexually assault prison inmates. It's the weakest people and the people who, again, it's like the trial by combat thing. It's like you take the people who, if you're an innocent person who hasn't committed murder, who gets convicted and thrown in jail, like, you're in a much worse position than the murderer who gets thrown in jail. It's just a bad place for a nonviolent person to be.
Again, to this day, when I hear very leftist, like hippie types feeling sorry for prisoners, there are plenty of monsters in prison. There are plenty of them. Psychopaths, sociopaths, people who have done despicable things, who have harmed children, who have mutilated women, who have done, take your pick. Like, they need to be somewhere away from everybody. The problem is, when we think of a prisoner, we always think of that. Either a big tattooed biker guy or skinhead, or a stereotypical thug that's a, you know, a big scary black guy or whatever. You've got this kind of idea in your head of a cartoon villain. A very, very large percentage of the people who are in the criminal justice system, like, the reason other countries don't have our incarceration rates, and in fact have a fraction of our incarceration rates, we have something like 25% of all the prisoners in the world, even though we've only got 5% of the population. In other words, like, it's five times more likely you're going to go to jail in the United States than almost anywhere else, is because we use prison as a catch-all for everybody who can't function in this system, in this economy. If you got something wrong with you, when I say something wrong, anything from schizophrenia to some sort of mental disability, or if you've just got a personality that you can't work, like, you just, maybe you're so oppositional to authority that you can't stand being told what to do. Like, if you wind up where you can't get a job, and I'm talking about the type of people that can't even get a job at Burger King, like, somebody, like, you're too scary looking or you're too twitchy, like, they don't need to hire you. They've got clean looking college kids they can hire to work the register. You know, they're not going to allow you around food. A place isn't going to allow, you know, going to hire you to mop the floors because you can't be trusted around dangerous chemicals. If you're one of these fringe types, and there are tens of millions of these people, we've never figured out what to do with these people. When they get locked out of the economy, they cannot work. Like, they have no place in the system. They are going to wind up in the criminal justice system. They are. Because what are they going to do for money? They're going to steal. They're going to sell drugs. They're going to go to the underground economy. And then we will pick them up and throw them in jail, just as we throw prostitutes in jail. We throw people who frequent prostitutes in jail. Like, these crimes that It's just people functioning outside of what's an acceptable way to make money. Jail is where we put them. Prison is where we put them. And it is this incredibly expensive, something to the tune of like $40,000 a year per prisoner. It's this incredibly expensive and incredibly cruel form of welfare. Like, it would be far more cost effective just to pay these people to stay home and not bother anybody. Like, if you just gave them half that money and said, we will pay you just to not commit crime. Like, you don't have to go get a job. We're just going to pay you to stay home. But in return, you're not allowed to, like, deal drugs or shoot people or whatever. And then got them, like, mental health services. It would be far, far more effective because you would save money elsewhere.
They've literally done that in Oakland. I think it was some part of a major city that had a huge gang violence problem. And a former gang member came, gathered up the people who the police suspected were the ones committing most of the murders. It was like, you know, 25 people, and said, we will put you on this payment plan. All you have to do is come to these meetings once a month and take our money, essentially, and, you know, not commit murder. And the people were like, okay. And it worked as long as it had funding, and then it lost funding because it sounds crazy. Like, there's a logic to it that just doesn't work for the theater of how America likes to think of itself. One thing that I think is worth pointing out is we do arrest prostitutes. It's extremely rare in our interviews with cops and prostitutes. It's extremely rare that people who frequent prostitutes get arrested. And part of this could be a representation or like an issue of the people who are making the laws are high achieving people who don't have mental health problems. And so they're just building a system that treats horribly people who do have mental health problems, who have substance abuse problems. But it's just interesting to me that the one type of people that politicians and the people who design the system have some sympathy for is, you know, the mostly men who frequent prostitutes. That doesn't shock me, I guess.
But that's a good example, though, because you have a class of women who they don't qualify for any other type of work. So they've fallen into this, you know, if you're a libertarian type, then you should have no problem with it because you've got consenting adults selling a service. You've got customers that are consenting adults paying for a service. They're receiving exactly what they paid for. They're satisfied with the transaction to the point that they return to the same one and again and again. Like, in a perfect world, there's no reason that would be illegal. Now, in our imperfect world, part of the issue is that you have issues with human trafficking, you have underage women, you have women who get forced into it by violence. So there's a lot of complicating factors there. But it still doesn't change the fact that if you have a type of transaction society doesn't approve of, that it thinks it can somehow fix that by incarcerating somebody. And the things that led to the person being in that situation are not fixed by incarceration. See, the whole theory here is supposed to be that it's a deterrent. People are scared of going to jail so they don't commit crimes. In reality, that does not work. The countries that have scarier prisons do not have lower crime rates. And the countries like in the Netherlands and Sweden, yeah, places like that, yeah, where they're more about rehabilitation, about like they have very nice prisons, they've got lower recidivism rates, they've got lower crime rates. But we can't tolerate the idea of someone, quote unquote, getting away with murder. The idea that we're not getting revenge on the bad people is galling to us. Because, again, we define righteousness by being evil to evil men or evil women. Like, doing damage to the bad guys is how we define being good. Because all of the good guys in movies, they define their goodness by killing and or torturing the bad guys. And we celebrate them for that. So if we're not doing that, that must mean that we support evil and we support crime. And any politician that supports more rehabilitation, this sort of thing, even if they can statistically prove that it lowers crime, makes people safer, lowers rates of people reoffending, it doesn't matter. Because we want to be tough on crime, and we define being tough on crime as inflicting pain upon the criminals. And because such a large percentage of these people are not evil in any sense of the word, but are just
either mentally ill or just they've got had a horrible background and had no role models, have no skills to offer the world. It doesn't matter. Like, you can't reform the system, and you can't, like, even as inefficient and expensive as this system is, if you try to stand up and say, you know what, these people shouldn't be in jail, you will be met by a rallying cry of, oh, you want to turn these animals out onto the street to rape and kill our daughters. And then very first time one of these people you released kill somebody, then your entire system will be declared invalid. And even people like campaigning to, you know, close Guantanamo because you've got suspected terrorists who have no evidence against them, but they've been held there for years. It doesn't matter if you release hundreds of those people who are innocent. The moment one of them turns out to really be a terrorist, then the entire release system is declared to be evil, and you'll be blamed for everyone that dies because of this one terrorist you released. As if it's better to imprison 10 innocent people as long as we make sure we get the one bad guy.
It makes a sort of sense to me, like the logic I hadn't considered, because thinking about someone who's deciding whether to commit their first crime, you're creating an adversarial relationship with the populace by not working. Like, you will respect the rules and intentions of a system that at least makes a sort of sense. But if you live in a community where people are coming out of jail telling you, I was, you know, mentally tortured for a year while I was in there, put in solitary confinement, from that point forward, you're not thinking of it as like a system that's worth working within, because it doesn't make sense. It's insane and it's not fair. And that logic makes sense to me as to why places with crueler prisons don't have lower crime rates. People aren't being scared off. The world needs to make sense to them for them to want to live within your world.
Right. And this is also why, like, harsher religions that basically say that anything other than going to church is sin are not, like, those populations don't have lower crime rates. They're not any better people because it's impossible to meet that standard. So at some point you just give up. And in the worst neighborhoods, they simply see the police as a rival gang. Because everybody's got an example of a police brutality case. Everybody's got an example of somebody who was harassed just for walking along the sidewalk. Everybody's got an anecdote from a friend who were jammed up by the system because they didn't, you know, they were just, the cops came along and they needed to make an arrest that day in their minds. Or, you know, they knew for a fact they weren't there, but they matched the description, quote unquote, and the description being black male. And so they got taken in and harassed for an entire day before being released. Or they were doing a stop and frisk thing and the person talked back. They got taken in for resisting arrest, which, yes, you can be arrested for resisting arrest even if it turns out there was no reason for the arrest. If the arrest was completely invalid, if you resisted, if you pulled away, if you were verbally abusive or whatever, doesn't matter. You can still be stopped and harassed into resisting and get taken in on the resisting charge. Like, so they just see the police as just another, it's just a bunch of violent rivals they've got to overcome, and you treat them like another gang. You're not going to comply. You're going to try to circumvent them, to avoid them, to do whatever, but that's just another gang you're at war with. Why would you respect the authority of that system where you don't even call the police when you're the victim of a crime? Because you don't trust them. You would take care of it in-house. You would try to go find out who did it. There's a reason they don't recognize that authority. It's because in many, many cases, they've been trained not to.
You killed my brother last winter. You shot him 3 times in the back.
All right, hope you guys enjoyed that conversation. You just heard a little bit of, and we're going to ride out on Ween's silly but narratively effective revenge ballad, Buenos Tardes, Amigos. It's basically a short story from the perspective of a narrator speaking to someone he's holding prisoner who, as you heard, he claims murdered his brother. I'm going to skip forward a few verses. They really take their time telling the story, but basically he says his mother loved his brother was head honcho with the ladies. Again, not the most authentic representation of Mexican dialect, but his brother was big man on campus in their small town. When his body is found, he vows revenge on the person he's talking to, who he claims is the killer. He tells the people of his village, that he's going to catch this guy and vows to upstand the law. And that's where we are. Hope you enjoy the song. Hope you enjoyed this week's episode. And we'll be back next week with more podcast. Talk to you then, guys. Thanks.
The people of the village believed me. Mama, she wanted revenge. I told her that I'd see that she was honored. I'd find you and put you to death. Such a joyous day. I tell you, it was me who killed him. But the truth I'll never have to say. Buenos tardes, amigo. Hola, my good friend. Cinco de Mayo on Tuesday, and I hoped we'd see each other again. Yes, I hoped we'd see each other again. I hoped we'd see each other again.
Today's episode was brought to you by Lynda.com. If you want to be a better photographer, they've got classes on how to do that. If you want to make your website better, you can learn how at Lynda.com, whether it's learning how to code or how to do graphic design. Basically, no matter what you're looking to do, they've probably got a course on it. So go to Lynda.com/crack today. That's Lynda.com/crack for a 10-day free trial. Thanks, Lynda, and thank you guys for listening.
This has been an Earwolf Media production. Executive producers Jeff Ulrich and Scott Aukerman. For more information, visit earwolf.com.
Earwolf Radio, boom.com. The wolf dead.